Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otter. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Liz Gebhardt. Liz Gebhardt is a global executive, non-executive director and board advisor, angel investor, DEI specialist, and public speaker. With over 20 years' experience driving innovation and digital transformation in Forbes' top 20 industry-leading companies, including Amazon and Target, Liz has led multi-billion, multifunction businesses in the US, EU, and worldwide. Formerly head of global strategy and operations for inclusive experiences and technology at Amazon, Liz is passionate about creating inclusive cultures, advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion at all levels, and empowering organizations to achieve sustainable growth through technology and customer experience. Now serving as a fractional chief operations and commercial leader, Liz continues her work to change outcomes and unlock potential for diverse founders, organizations, and leaders. Liz says, "The biggest risks I've taken in my career always drove the best results, whether it was a promotion, learning, or just progress. And at the heart of having the confidence to take the leap is backing and trusting yourself." Liz Gebhardt, welcome to Speech Bubbles.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So, Liz, tell us about the biggest risk you took in your career and how you trusted yourself to do that.
I feel I've taken a few big swings in my career. I think a couple that were most notable to me, first and foremost, I think taking a leap to move across countries. So moving from the US to the UK, both was a big personal but professional aspect for me as well. I moved to the UK knowing one person personally. So effectively from a life perspective, it was a big shift. But also from a cultural perspective, I was really aiming to get an experience working outside the US to broaden my perspectives. And that risk significantly unlocked more opportunities than I had thought it would be over a longer term horizon. So I think that was a big risk just from a personal and professional perspective. And then I have shifted across different functional areas relatively frequently in my career, which always feels like risks depending. But I think one of the other large ones I took was after 18, 19 years as a commercial and operational leader, shifting to support functions within human resources. So I'd always been a leader, supporting the human resources teams, but shifting to take on a functional role leading the global diversity, equity, inclusion, global inclusive experiences aspects was a big swing. It's one that I had, it was a measured risk in the sense that I at least knew some of the people I'd be working with or kind of supporting, but it was taking a big bet on trying to shift my skill sets into a totally different functional piece, learning a lot of different things that I had not understood before about how the global aspect of HR functions and all the different aspects there, but ultimately too shifting seats from being a decision-making commercial leader to being in those support structure roles that are critical in organizations, but often don't necessarily have the same visibility or support that are needed. So I was grateful for the opportunities that were available, but definitely felt at the time like a big shift out of what I knew pretty well to something that was pretty new for everybody. I was building the function from scratch and doing a lot of stuff as well. So So those are a couple, at least, that come to mind in terms of big risks, but ultimately have all enabled me to continue to grow as a leader and develop different skills than I had previously.
It's such a great lesson, isn't it, that risk can pay off? And I think that people avoid risk because it's that fear of change. And at the moment, you're constantly being asked to attend events or speak at events in London where you live, where there's this common theme about change, whether it's in tech, whether it's in investing, whether it's about gender parity. And I see that as a common theme, that you've always worked you've worked on change outcomes and how they unlock potential. What do you feel is the biggest change on the agenda for people in work right now, and what's the most urgent?
Yeah, I see two kind of key themes coming through that are really significant. So first and foremost, we are fast approaching an environment in which, for the first time in history, we have possibly five generations in the workforce working together. That has never happened in history before. If you think about how quickly generations are progressing, usually supported by technology as a foundation. But what that means, different to kind of previous generations who may have had a more similar ties, so boomers to Gen X to Gen Y pieces, there might have been a bit more common threads. We now have a complete division between people that grew up completely digitally native, also possibly going through major lifestone moments in this latest pandemic that were affecting how they also were able to socialize and learn different skill sets, with a workforce that's still critical from previous generations that has incredible knowledge, incredible understanding of these kind of key decision pieces and how to run. But bringing all those people together is a really complicated challenge. And for many companies, especially trying to attract new talent and hold on to old, you know, previous tenants are not old, but hold on to previous generations, it is a key challenge that work teams are facing right now. And second, kind of coupled with that, is the acceleration and impact of artificial intelligence, so AI, specifically generative AI. I think what people kind of view AI as this new thing, it's not. It's been around for 50 plus years. It's just how we're experiencing it in different parts of the workplace is changing. This fundamentally started with everything from machine learning, from programming in the core. All of that started with the fundamentals of what AI is now evolving into. And we're still at kind of early stage of what generative is capable of. But I think what's happening with organizations is they're making quick decisions about what they think something is ready for without kind of that fundamental structure and support in place. I kind of equate it to if you were to hire a new cashier in a store and have a playbook that they'd always follow, how to check someone out, kind of experience, and suddenly putting that person in charge of a $50 billion business without any manuals or support or checking if the manual is the right one. So AI is doing a lot of great things, and it has a lot of great capability in the future, but there's a lot of fundamentals that have to be addressed in terms of the data structures, the way in which people are building agents on top of particularly biased data sets, which I'm sure we can touch on from a inclusion and diversity perspective. But we are at a big risk right now if people are jumping too far ahead before it's ready for prime time. And ultimately, AI and technology has always been an enabler of people, not a full replacement. There are always things that should come that are replaced because they create more time for people that should be doing other things. So it's work that's repetitive that shouldn't need a person to press a button over and over. But it is not and should not be a full-scale replacement for people by any means. So I think we're at these kind of two precipices that are really interlinked, but trying to bring people along in that process as well, I think, is where workforce is really facing some interesting challenges right now.
Yeah, that both of those feel urgent, Liz. And this is for first and foremost a leadership podcast. What do both those sets of changes bring to bear for leaders?
I think from the conversations I have at board level, at advisor or startup level, and with peers that I kind of previously worked with, I think the things they're bringing to bear are, it feels really, you know, to your point, the urgency of this feels like it's house on fire. we must make a decision now, but also be understanding the impact 10, 20 years down the line. So people are struggling with kind of making a short-term decision that will have long-term effects, and don't have or feel informed enough to do that. So there's a lot of leadership pressure to kind of assume they know everything that's going on with this. And they're struggling to kind of take a step back and ask questions and challenge and, you know, really be able to kind of have those open dynamic work conversations, because people just feel like it has to be done now, now, now. And in contrast to that, I think leaders are still, unfortunately, the diversity of leadership makeup is not necessarily reflective of the people that will be most affected by this, not just an employee perspective, but a customer perspective. So there is risks that if that those groups are not represented in some of those conversations now, it's not a short-term effect we're going to face. It's, you know, businesses will have massive swings of impacts not too long from now. This is particularly happening if you look at spaces like medical research, medical advancement. That's a huge risk if there's not some pretty big shifts quickly in terms of data sets and people representing in leadership levels. But that's also in, you know, the AI space. There's space in technology and sustainability. There's all these spaces that need a lot more diversity to help bring those conversations forward. And not diversity from a gender or a racial or other lens. It is also diversity of thought, different experiences, you know, different backgrounds, and different generations, frankly. We can't just have a group that's never lived an experience digitally native only making those decisions without some of that information. So it's this kind of, where is there safe space to ask questions and not know is disappearing, but also the lack of visibility to the corners to look around and what those could come get people seems to be accelerating as well.
Yeah, and it seems like the two things that you mentioned, which are the most urgent, are kind of getting more and more squashed together in this vector of urgency. One thing I heard a CEO say recently, he said, you know, the managers in his team have this incredible pressure of leadership and having to manage their teams. But at the same time, they're also having to think about how AI is going to completely reinvent their function. So on top of leading their teams, they're also working on reinvention. And that's an incredible pressure on individuals.
I think that's an excellent point. And in particular, I think one of the things that I've seen most in my journey through leadership is the perspective that leadership is just the top level C-suite folks that are in that bubble making those decisions. But people that are most generally affected day to day, really facing the brunt of leadership, are those frontline managers or middle managers. In they are given all of the messaging top down from the leadership teams on what's coming and execute this, but then bottoms up also from the teams themselves saying, what's happening? How can I do this? And they're kind of waiting for the information of what's happening, but they're still trying to raise concerns. So you have that incredible compressed points of center, and ultimately, the people that are most critical to sustain culture in companies are those people actually physically talking to people every day, or in that kind of the people experience a company by their leadership team. They do not experience it generally by the giant innocuous operating body at the top. They experience it from who they see day to day. So if those groups are not brought into the conversation or feel like they're part of the change management or, you know, open spaces again, it's a huge risk as well, just because you put so much compressed pressure on that space that they can't function in both of those ways that you mentioned.
Yeah, and it's such a great point as well that seeing the people behave, seeing your leaders, your managers behave, is the transformational moment. So if you see how people show up, that's telling you as an employee, okay, this is what leadership are doing. So the middle managers end up being not only the culture translators, they're the transformation translators. With AI, they're the technology translators. And these are people who, I mean, I personally, no leadership training, just now you're a manager, go for it, you know? So they, on some levels, making it up as they go along.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think in particular in corporate structures and in technology as well, in order to progress, everyone was sort of told the only path to do that is through leadership. And there are, you know, generally, if you think about the superpowers of individuals, some people are really great leaders. Some people probably would be better in other spaces. But if that's the only path that they have, to your point, they're sort of gifted upon responsibility that they may or may not want. But also then are lacking that core structure of, what training looks like and companies investing in that, what it takes to be early stage leaders, because you get a lot of behaviors from just observing other people then. And again, if you don't have ways to develop your own style, then it's you repeat the same cycle over and over of leaders in that journey. So
Yeah, I've seen that a lot. So Liz, I'm sure when you were young, you didn't imagine you were going to grow up and become a commercial and operations manager. Walk us through your leadership journey.
sure. So I grew up in the Midwest of the US. So majority of the people that were around me were teachers, were educators, were in public service, including my mother worked for the church for 50 years. My father did as well, but then became self-employed. So most of the examples I'd had were in, core professions, helping people. But I, through just means of growing up as I did, ended up needing to work full-time when I was in university. So started out in one of the, shift jobs that was easiest to manage my schedule, and that was in retail. So I worked in physical retail stores from the time I was 15, effectively, all the way through end of university. And interestingly, relative to leadership, my senior year of uni ended up being a store manager at one of the biggest women's clothing stores in the Mall of America in the U.S. And what was it?
Name
It
it. What was the store?
was called New York and Company. Don't know that they are still around. But I was 20 years old and suddenly in charge of a workforce of 100 people at any given time. And that was shift work and building schedules and, the basics of kind of leadership in that sense of just keeping the store afloat while managing things. But what I learned really early on was that that was something that was really exciting to me. I think I was able to help, create opportunities for people, but also I appreciated the opportunity to kind of be sitting at the 10,000 foot level of what I know needed to happen at the store to get everything working, but then also at the 3 foot level of troubleshooting and being with customers and doing those pieces. So I really enjoyed that part of it. I didn't expect that to inform my longer term leadership journey, but I ended up out of university getting a role within Target Corporation, which was a dream job for me at the time because it was the company that was I grew up with and it was sort of my dream company, but was actually allocated to the online side. And online was brand new, so dating myself about
Wow.
early days of online retail in that we were still also running catalog businesses off the side. So we were both physical catalog and this online startup-y thing. Ironically, though, we were backed by Amazon. So Amazon was the marketplace for the online marketplace. So I effectively started in this kind of journey of really kind of fast tech supply chain, things that I had not at all had training for in a physical store environment, suddenly in this online space. But really loving that diving in and constantly problem solving, really kind of building quickly and just seeing the impact of how fast things were shifting in that way. So, kind of built different ways there through individual roles for my first few years in career, but then was asked to stand up some of our entertainment businesses and build stuff from scratch. And that was also my first time to build out a team in a
Wow.
corporate environment. So, building from what I learned from leadership, kind of building that into the structure there. But I, really loved that part of the mix of this fast-paced tech environment, moving from supply chain to commercial to my last role at Target. I was in omnichannel store of the future, kind of visioning and strategy. So I loved that balance of things that afforded me. And after 9 years there, moved over to Amazon, starting back out in their commercial business. And one of the things that I was really clear about as I started that journey were, well, two things actually. First is that I knew people leadership was something that I wanted to be a core part of my informed longer term career path, but also that I was really keen to use that opportunity to leverage to work abroad because Amazon was an international company, and I thought that was the right way to kind of move it forward. So, and try to continue to take advantage of that. So, started out in U.S. leadership in the books team, and then moved over. Was asked to come and help lead the video games team in the UK to start with. So again, kind of going back to those really tough problem-solving moments, it was in a big turnaround time for the business. So got to jump in, but also then learn this totally different perspective of customer behavior in the UK and Europe, and really get to dive into a lot of those problem sets again. So I've always kind of taken that balance in my leadership journey of how does this scare me? And it should scare me enough that I'm going to learn something from it. I try to think about it. Amazon has a famous mental model called the two-way door decision. So if the door can swing back and it's not going to be such a risk that you can't move back and forth through the door, you know, you should take a calculated risk to take it. And I viewed that as a two-way door decision. If I came over here and didn't like it, I could always come back. Really loved it though, so kept that door swinging. But I think the main thing that I continued to look for is I expanded in my leadership journey from leading video games, then moved over to fashion, chief of staff, technical officer, kind of helping the leadership team evaluate a big amount of change we were going through in Europe, leading a bunch of teams that were kind of in it, like indirectly and then directly leading, launching a BI function from scratch, business intelligence, excuse me. You know, I just kept getting opportunities to kind of plug into different problem sets through leadership teams, learning at a broader level, then taking on what ended up being one of my most formative leadership experiences was leading a team business within fashion, as well as our expanded services organization. But with that challenge, I took that job a week, 10 days before COVID, was initially leading a team of 125 across 7 countries. And then 2 weeks later, we suddenly became a fully virtual team of that size globally. So we were different time zones, different cultures, and also a quite young workforce. So I was tasked not just with continuing to lead the business, but also how do you build this safe environment for teams to kind of manage through that key time. And then also not just manage it, but I also was tasked with growing that organization. So ended up growing that organization by another 100 people before I left the role. So it's how do you build culture? How do you build that structure for an organ, not just a direct line leader, but an organizational structure. So leader of leaders within that space. And that was huge for me. But that enabled me then to be able to then take on more global roles because as, you know, learning virtual leadership skills, I was then able to, when I was tapped to kind of consider taking on leading our global diversity, equity, and inclusion functions, I was considering a lot of different things, but that seemed like a great opportunity to then lead even a more global team. So I ended up leading a team across 12 time zones, representing 65 plus countries, which was an incredible learning, but also, again, kind of building into those challenges was scared me a bit. It continued to give me a different lens of what different needs were across people, but also just continually opportunities to keep solving, you know, new problems and really challenging problems across a quite diverse space of issues. So a little bit of a whistle stop in that sense, but I think it's, you know, to your point, what's informed it for me is my through line is sort of a mix of, you know, effectively digital transformation is transforming teams, functions, et cetera, to kind of change behavior. But a lot of that too was building and just energizing around building more diverse teams and bringing more people along with me. I think I was often the only woman in the room in many cases in my career, and it gave me new energy to kind of make sure that a part of my focus as a leader was always bringing others along in that journey with me then as well.
Yeah. Liz, you talk about sometimes feeling a little bit scared and about at the beginning we talked about risk. And in our interview for We Need New Leaders, you talked about both the self-learning and the vulnerability that you experienced when you took on some of these bigger global roles. Could you talk about what you learned?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that was important to me in terms of the self-learning aspect is that it's arrogant of a leader to take on a role and assuming you can do 100% of it to 100% bar from day one. I think if you're doing that, then that role to me is not stretching you enough or not giving you an opportunity to kind of build different skills. I think for myself, what I tried to approach as self-learning was being as transparent as I could with my line leaders that were reporting or that were I was directly reporting to on what I thought my strengths were, but also where I was looking for their support in development. And then similarly, sharing some of those development needs with the people that reported to me. I think it's important to make sure that you create environments that you have feedback from different angles, but also that people are aware, hey, you know, she told me she's not the best at this thing. So maybe that's why we're having this discussion. Maybe I could help, you know, bridge the gap here kind of piece. So I tried to be as transparent as possible. That's been a critical aspect of that. And then I think relative to kind of the risk taking and those components and building it, I think I've always been a person that is curious. And I think curiosity is fundamentally critical in leadership. I think it allows you to ask the why. So I often approached problems kind of, I guess, an annoying toddler of just asking continually, but why? But why? And the information from that, both for my own development, but also then in creating environments in which I was curious and trying to kind of get to root cause, created that. And ultimately with the why shows vulnerability in the sense that if you're asking why, it's because you don't know yourself and you might have an opinion, and creating environments in which you're curiously asking questions and showing where you have both strengths and opportunities, I think it creates safe spaces, so like psychological safety for people to also then understand that. And one of the things I tried to do with my leadership teams, the people that reported to me constantly were, you know, while we're sharing wins, it was also sharing, whew, I made this mistake this week. And, you know, I shouldn't have done that. This is what I learned from it, moving it forward. And I think creating vulnerability in that space was key, because then that opened the door for other people to experiment and to feel like that was an environment in which they weren't going to get blasted publicly. It wasn't going to be an environment of shame. I had experienced that as a leader, and that was something I very much was very clear. I don't want to see that. I don't want to repeat that experience, that behavior in other people. But the other piece in vulnerability, I think that really came, again, COVID, I think, was a really different time for all leaders, in which there was such an environment of we all had to kind of safely admit we didn't know. We didn't know what was coming relative to consumer behavior or financial structures, anything really. And ultimately, what we really had to refocus on is, are people safe? You know, are we, you have the tools you need to at least do the job we know we need to do today? And how do we set shorter term views to be able to kind of keep moving through this process? But I think the most important thing during that time was, you know, being able to share, this is what I know, this is what I don't know, and this is how we're going to get through that. And I've tried to take that forward now into other leadership roles, especially when it's new spaces, really dynamically changing environments, like the topics of diversity, equity, inclusion, or AI and inclusion in tech. Those are super unknown spaces in general, in terms of where it's going. And it's really important to kind of level set, this is what we know, this is what we don't, and this is how we're going to keep solving that. And I think just continuing to create those spaces in which you're vulnerable ultimately just benefits people in being able to have psychologically safe environments. And that's proven through significant studies and data that the more safe people feel at work, first of all, the more fully they'll show up at work, so the more engaged. But ultimately, the better decisions you can come out of that, because you can see around more corners, you can see more questions coming through, you could avoid more obvious mistakes because people don't feel like they're asking a dumb question. So I think it's really important to role model that. And of course, I failed as many times as I succeeded, but I think the point is you try to keep showing your ability to express what you do and don't know, and then also demonstrating where and how you recovered from things that didn't work out, I think is key for people to be able to see that example in their leaders.
Yeah, and you used an important word there. You said show, and you know, telling people what kind of a leader you are, it's only half the job. The other half of the job is showing it in your behavior, and you did that by admitting your vulnerability in places where you had it, saying you didn't have all the answers, and that showed people there was space for them to do that as well, which I think is lovely. Liz, you had a big role in diversity and inclusion at Amazon, and you've mentioned the extreme need to ensure that we have proper inclusion in our tech and in AI. Let's talk a bit about what diversity means to you as an individual and a leader.
I love this question, and I've spoken about it with leaders at all levels. As an individual, what I view diversity as is effectively that we are all icebergs, and only 10% of what makes us diverse as individuals is visible above the surface. And for me, that's really important to keep in mind, because there's a lot of discussions about bias and where all those things come in. But ultimately, a very small part of what people might think makes you diverse is visible. And that's usually gender identity, possible identity of race or ethnicity, maybe even possible socioeconomic based on, you know, circumstances where you're living, et cetera. So there's very few things people can kind of quickly gather from a visual impression. And it takes time to go deeper into that surface, below the surface. And there's so many more things that inform us as individuals. So socioeconomic status, how we grew up, what our values were surrounded by, family, our health circumstances, our access to any services growing. I mean, there's so many factors that kind of inform our lived experience. And I think it's ignorant to assume that even people that might have come from a similar school or similar background all have that same collection of experiences. So diversity to me is sort of that iceberg visual model. I feel like that helps people think about it from a math perspective there. And then as a leader, I think it's both a responsibility to think about the collection of people on your team, but it is really ultimately bringing in then their diverse skill sets relative to functional experience, to capabilities that are beyond what you'd measure in an exam or a kind of a readiness for leadership, et cetera. And it takes a lot of time to ask questions and get to that. It's well beyond what you'd kind of gather from a CV. A CV and your LinkedIn is effectively your shiny examples of all the things that have gone right. And there's a lot of things that make us better decision makers because you see how people reacted when they messed up or when they might get that information. So as leaders, I think it's important to acknowledge the collective that you have on your teams and also identify where you might have gaps. And that's not necessarily looking at it only from, I certainly still believe that there are needs for lenses of gender and ethnicity. In particular, if you are a company in which 70% of your customers are women and you have 10% of women on your leadership team, you're going to miss business. There's obvious things you're going to miss from that. If you're operating in the Global South, you don't have members of your leadership team that are part of that group, you are significantly at risk of missing business. So there's some basic things you need to be accountable to as a leader and the diversity of your team. But I think what's even more important is diversity of thought. If you hire a bunch of people that think like you, that came from the same background that you, that sound like you, you might have cohesion and you might all feel happy, you know, go lucky in the day to day, but you will not be successful long term. You can maybe be successful short term, but you will miss opportunities, you will, you know, miss talent that you could have developed and brought forward. It can create different dynamics and competition if everybody thinks they're equal. So it's really important to make sure that you're thinking about that as a leader. And for me, that was always an important component of who is better at this than I am and how do I bring them on board and help them succeed. I think it's super important to hire people that are smarter than you in a lot of different aspects and not necessarily using that as an educational framework, but just really better functionally at something because you as a leader are only as successful as the people around that you can enable for growth. So I think there's a lot of different aspects and diversity there, but you need to do work. You can't just kind of use a CV and a you know, phone screen quick check to validate that. You have to do the work to dive in with the teams and the individuals that are on your organization.
Yeah, thank you for that answer. It's such a very succinct answer to a very big set of problems. And I particularly like that metaphor of the iceberg. I'm probably going to steal it.
Please do. I stole it. There's free reign.
Free reign on the iceberg metaphor. So Liz, you're busy in a shift or a change of your own now, kind of out of corporate into emerging yourself into something new. How do you think about your own reputation?
Yeah, I think what I have always thought about relative to reputation, and this kind of goes back to a lot of the things that I was taught growing up, my values, my identity, and some of those pieces. But what really stuck with me, I cannot remember for the life of me who says the quote, but it's effectively, people will never remember what you say, but they will remember how you make them feel. And without the risk of making that too touchy-feely in terms of that, I think there's a lot of structural pieces about leading with empathy and those pieces. But ultimately, when I think about my reputation as a leader, for those that reported to me or were part of my organizations, I hope, you know, my reputation was that they thought that I was an inclusive leader, but a challenging leader. I don't want, you know, people to not have a high bar or to have challenging outcomes and to be successful. Like there was a, you know, a repetition that, but that I did that in a way that was enabling other people's space to thrive and sort of like to grow, not having it be my, you know, my fiefdom or whatever that may be. And for those I partnered with, I want to be known as someone that was a collaborative thought leader. But also one that was not afraid of confrontation, not afraid of asking tough questions, of challenging norms and making sure that we ultimately had the right outcomes. But ultimately doing that in the spirit of, but let's get to the solution. So here's, you know, what we think the problems are. This is what we have our blind spots are. Now how do we fix it? So I think really being solution minded, but it's kind of that balance of disruptive, but also collaborative, kind of finding that line. And doing that in a way that hopefully was clear across functions. So not having that just be a one trick aspect of my reputation, that I could replicate that across functions and teams. And lastly, I think just ultimately someone that people want to work with. That's really critical for me and reputation. you can do a lot of things that may make you successful on a checkbox exercise, but people may never want to talk to you or work for you or work near you again. And by no means do I want to create a reputation that that would be a case. So I hope I've created a reputation where people are excited to partner with me, know that I will challenge, but at the same point that the challenge is meant with outcomes to drive towards solutions. So reputation is critical to me because I just think it's something that you really can't buy. And it's something you have to show repeated over time. To your point, the show part is key. It's not just something you can put down on a pretty piece of paper or not having backed that up with pretty significant long-term visibility.
Yeah, and I love how you combined leading with empathy with being extremely businesslike about outcomes and being extremely effective with collaboration, because I'm seeing quite a lot of cynicism around empathy. We've heard certain leaders say empathy is dead or empathy is the bane of Western civilization. But we're also seeing people sort of fearing this return to command and control, and that empathy is somehow a soft skill. But the way you talk about it, I'm hearing you saying to me that empathy is extremely businesslike, that it's an extremely effective skill in helping people move from A to B.
I very much think, like many things in leadership styles, I think of empathy as sort of a blend of what would probably have previously been described as servant leadership, so enablement and building of others. But fundamentally, it's about listening. And it's about adapting and it's about adjusting. So that's kind of where situational leadership comes into play and some of those kind of traditional definitions of leadership. And I view that as critical of if you want a leadership career over a long span of time, the idea of not being adaptable and being able to shift, especially with how quickly the world around us is shifting. I think thinking you can approach the problem set by repeating your same playbook over and over again, acting the same way with every team, command and control, we know all the outcomes, that requires you knowing all the answers. And we're not in an environment right now where as leaders we can do that. And I totally agree that empathy is practiced as a soft skill. There's ways to do that in a way that feels authentic to individuals. But that does not, in my view, mean that it's this touchy-feely, people are walking all over you, there's not that outcome. You have to set both expectations, as I said. You can show and demonstrate that you're a safe space for the team and that you want to create environments where there's discussions and dialogue, but you don't then turn around and change to say, well, I know everyone had a tough week, so let's just forget about results. That's not what empathy is about. Empathy is really just fundamentally about listening and adapting and helping others adapt quickly. So I agree that it's under attack in a lot of ways. And I think that's where it's been frustrating to see some of the discussions around diversity, equity, inclusion, inclusive leadership being dismissed in that way. I think the other piece of that comes with empathy equating to feminine leadership and command and control relating to masculine. I don't necessarily believe there's a gendered role in that. It's certainly longevity-wise shown out differently over time. But just because I identify as a woman leader and I identify as someone who's empathetic and inclusive, that does not mean that I am sacrificing that for performance and expectations on my team. Mm-hmm. So, but it is, I think you're still fighting that battle of, being nice to people is still generally a way to get them to want to work for you and work with you. And I think we're losing that a little bit in the discussion around other politicized aspects of it. So it's, I do think it's critical for the adaptability of an organization long-term. And it's just down to me a bit simpler than this, touchy-feely aspect of it. I think it's just a lot more simple.
Absolutely. My last interviewee described it as being a likable badass.
I will steal that tagline. I appreciate that.
So happy we could share
exactly,
today.
Exactly.
So Liz, with We Need New Leaders and the podcast, I have a passion and a mission to change. It goes back to command and control maybe, but this sort of old archetype we have in our brains, what a leader looks like, loud, room owning, big energy. I want to make space and open space for all types of leadership to come to the fore, especially with the emerging leaders. What do you think we can do both collectively and individually to change that old archetype?
I think first and foremost, it does come down to more individuals being a bit bolder in demonstrating this consistently. So it is that mix of empathy to me can be as simple as asking a question if you're having a big debate in a leadership room of what's the impact on the team if we do this? Or is there risk from customers' perspective that they won't understand us? Those are demonstrations of empathy in that you're just opening the door for a human conversation in part and play to business. But it also challenges perspectives of the change management aspect of this can't exclude those populations. So I think there's ways to be, finding ways to kind of do that in ways that people feel comfortable with. But we also have to celebrate examples where you see someone that's willing to step forward and be bolder and recognize that dynamic shifted. So it is a mix of rewarding that kind of leadership with promotion, with support. I have seen, unfortunately, a number of times in my career where that archetype was celebrated and put forward more just because it was more similar to the other leaders. So that kind of is where another action that we really need to take is interrupting unconscious bias, which there's a lot of conversation about. But the bias for us to have similarity bias, hire people that look or act or sound more like us. The proximity bias, people that we see more often that are close by. Recency bias. So they did one good thing now, but I forgot about the 12 months of other things that went wrong. So there's a lot of things that we have to really challenge as leadership teams of making sure there's safe spaces in the room as those, particularly the performance and hiring conversations are happening to say, okay, well, you knew that person in that context. This is my experience. Or are we missing out on these other aspects because we have this one, we're all similar in this view. So there does need to be a bit more interruption in those spaces to kind of be able to create more spaces. But I also think a big part of this has to come from if you kind of reset where the conversations are coming from, sometimes it makes the conversation easier. So rather than making it about an individual on the team, if there's a big decision needed to be made as a company, I find that generally using the lens of the end customer, so who we're going to generate income from, if we're using the framing of, well, I think, or this customer is going to experience this change, this is the outcome, and you can bring more math and kind of more things that people are comfortable with having that debate within. Generally speaking, I find kind of neutralizes a little bit more of the sensitivity around the topic itself. So I think finding, customer is one example, but finding a common denominator in which everyone's motivated for and using that as a frame, I think is another easier way in for people. And then really the math exercise just to be, we need to get more voices in the rooms so that those conversations can more naturally happen and people can more naturally kind of represent themselves. I think that's going to come from, as we talked about the core lenses of diversity in leadership teams, but also the generational aspect is coming fast. And technology, for example, is not just the CTO's problem. Technology is embedded across every function. So people having to take ownership over topics like that, I think, again, create spaces to say, okay, we know about this stuff. I don't know about this. Talk about this. And again, that's softer inclusion because you're being vulnerable. You're demonstrating where you need to have conversations. So I think trying to make it this big politicized aspect of it is where we've fallen down a little bit and really breaking it back down to if we know we have to solve this customer problem, how do we work together on this? If we have this aspect to consider from an organizational perspective, how would that change our outcome? So I think if you bring it back to more common denominators, that just creates a better safe space for leadership teams to be able to do that. And also sometimes things like reverse mentoring. So having some of the junior leaders reverse mentor the senior leaders or, creating more sponsorships so people are brought forward in different ways. I think there's lots of ways we can solve it as individuals and as leaders. But it does come from a blend of that role modeling, getting more people through the door, and ultimately just creating more spaces where people can admit they don't know, and they need to have discussions about it. So, appreciate those. None of those are easy, easy things to do, but I think it does take iterative things, and it takes representing your different identities to do that as individuals, not necessarily as a collective company, but.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that lens of let's find a common denominator and solve towards that, and then it's less about what are the differences in the room, but who are we all working together for? Which is a really great insight. So now we get to the questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
I have, I'm going to cheat and have two that I found to be really
Two's
impactful for
good.
myself. So Rebel Ideas by Matthew Syed, I think is a really great one that talks through just different ways to think about solving complex problems as an individual and as a leader. So that's one I highly recommend. And then the culture map is particularly for anyone that's a global leader, one that I have found just fundamental. I think one of the most impactful experiences I had when I was leading really global teams is really just understanding how critical that thing situational leadership is. And the culture map was a really great way just to understand more culturally how different countries, different regions operate, not just in communication style, but in customer style, leadership style, in, you know, core anything. So I find that one to be really impactful, particularly for global leaders or people that are aspiring to be global leaders. I think it's an important one. So
great. Thank you. So Liz, we need new leaders. It's very much, although it reflects the experience of established leaders like yourself, it's very much aimed in the direction of emerging leaders who want to land, keep, or create their dream leadership roles. And they come from diverse backgrounds, diverse identities, potentially underrepresented minorities. Maybe their diversity is under the water of the iceberg and can't be seen. What three tips do you have for them?
First, ask. I think what's most important, if you have ambitions to have leadership be part of your experience, you have to ask. And it's not just your line leader. It's being clear to outline why you're interested, what skills you think you bring to the table. So it's not a transactional ask. It's a clear, this is my direction. This is my path. This is what I'd like to do. So you have to be clear on what you want. You cannot ask what you, or you cannot receive what you don't ask for, effectively. Number two is be curious. I think being observant of leaders that you are inspired by, but equally leaders that you react in a poor way from. I've learned just as much from people I don't want to emulate as people I do. So I think that comes from asking questions. If you observe a leader in a room and you're really inspired by them, ask them for a coffee. You have to be kind of learning too, not just in that context, but really actively kind of seeking out those mentors. I've had huge benefit in my career of staying close to people that I was most inspired by and continue to be inspired by, because you just kind of continue to ask about those components. And then the third, I think, is to bring others forward. So one of the best ways I learned early on in leadership is having direct reports is by no means the only way you can be a leader. You can offer to mentor. You can coach and teach different programs within your organization. You can volunteer. There's a lot of leadership skills you build in helping others and just understanding what that takes. Being a leader is really tough. It is a great responsibility, but it is also a great amount of different work. It is not to speak about the admin burden and things like that, but there are a lot of responsibilities you take on as a leader. Because you are now not just responsible for your own outcomes, you're responsible for the outcomes of a team. And how you deliver that is, you know, really different to how you would yourself manage time. You have to let go of some things. You have to trust. You have to build those structures that you audit. But you cannot execute everything the same way. So you have to make sure that you're kind of curious and thinking about how you're going to do that. And I found earlier leadership skills were much better learned from not having the responsibility fully, but kind of taking on those softer roles to really understand it. Because as much as it might sound great, you might uncover through those experiences that actually, rather than being a leader in that sense, you might want to take on a different responsibility. So there's more than one ways to be a leader. So don't wait for that just checkbox exercise if you suddenly have direct reports. That's not by any means the only way to be a leader.
Three great tips. Thank you so much, Liz. The world's tough at the moment. There's a lot to make us sad and weigh down on us. What brings you joy?
Well, I am a proud, proud auntie. So any time I get with my nieces and nephew are always energizing to me. But ultimately, I think my community. So being around my friends, I live far away from family. So being around my friends and community that I've chosen here is one big thing. But another thing that I'm just so excited about is getting to spend a lot of time right now with really young, energized founders. I particularly support diverse founders and women founders. But the types of solutions and businesses and everything that's being built is so exciting. I'm excited for what can come and what will come. But I think in a lot of ways, we just need to help get out of our own way in some of those pieces. So the joy of it comes from being around that, because it's energy that I need and, kind of I'm excited about seeing. But it does come at a balance of also making sure I prioritize my personal joy and spending time with those that uplift me and keep me above in this, to your point, this difficult time.
Oh, what a lovely answer. Liz Gebhardt, thank you for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.